public are duly notified of the meeting in accordance with the Freedom of Information Act. Nicole, you want to do a roll call?
Please. Councilmember Goshen?
Here.
Councilmember Hahn?
Here.
Councilmember Myers?
Here.
Councilmember Ward?
Here.
Councilmember Streetman?
Here.
Councilmember Popson?
Here.
Councilmember Anderson?
Here.
Councilmember Pierce?
Here.
Mayor Pounds?
Here.
Do you have a quorum?
Thank you. Citizen comments?
I had some people sign up that I don't see in the audience, but there are other people in the audience that makes me unsure whether or not I got all the press properly. So I don't have anybody, to my knowledge, signed up that is present.
Anybody here think they signed up and wanted to? Fair enough. Thank you. Special presentations, we don't have those tonight. Dashboard is in your packet and on the screen. Douglas?
Yeah, so just hit a few high points in the dashboard. We have pretty much in each department, we have one vacancy. City Hall, we're lacking in the building department. A business license clerk. Police department, we are still trying to hire one code enforcement officer. Fire department, we're trying to hire one firefighter. Public Works, one CDL driver, and then in police also, we still have the BSOs that we're trying to hire. So that's it in terms of vacancies. Just wanted to touch on a few upcoming events. We have community yard sale, March 25th, 8 to noon. Rec Center also has the egg hunt, April 7th. Coffee with the Mayor, Friday, March 31st, 9 a.m., Cafe Paname, and Music in the Park, May 6th, Saturday, at the Rec Center. Those are the highlights there. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have about the dashboard or the monthly reports that are in your packet.
Yeah.
Douglas, could you jump for not only my education, but for anybody else looking at this, city revenue by category, it shows that the sum of 23 budget is much higher than actual. Is that because the budget is for the full year?
Deb, you want to answer that?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
That's
the
correct.
Budget is a 12-month.
It's a 12-month budget, and we're only looking at 9 months of income. So we are on track.
Eight months.
So are we on track to meet or exceed budget?
Thank you. Yeah. We'll have a little more detail on the financials a little bit later, but yeah. Other questions on the dashboard or any of the departmental reports that were in your packet? Douglas, thank you.
Well, I have one question.
Sorry,
yeah. We're not having each of the department heads review anything. I have a question on the police report. I'm just confused about some of the charts on here, Chief. In particular, the livability. It says on the front page that you have zero calls on livability cases year to date. And then I go to the livability chart, and it shows, I don't know, 29 cases. And then on the graph on the below, I don't know what I'm reading, but it shows something like, I don't know, 100 and something cases. So How do I interpret that just for my own clarity of what I'm looking at?
Make sure I turn this on first.
I'm not sure I see the button.
One little button on top.
One little button? I'm pressing little buttons because I'm not sure they're the right ones. Easy peasy. Apologize about that. So what you're seeing on the first page, those numbers are coming from dispatch. So calls called into dispatch would be zero for livability cases. What we've got on the livability statistics would be calls that went directly to him or that he self-initiated. If he's riding around and he sees, for instance, complaints on trash cans, then he would address those and they would fall under the livability stats, not necessarily calls that were called into dispatch. And at the bottom, what you're seeing is you've got the graph. That's what you're asking about?
Yeah, I'm just trying to see, did those numbers come from the table above, or where did those numbers come from?
We're still streamlining these reports to figure out, make sure we're all getting the same reports, but they're all coming, they should be coming from the report above, and things that are, when you look at the first one, that's a quarter, so it's not just the month. The one above is just going to be for the month. Your graph is for everything January, February, and then it'll continue in that first quarter for March.
Okay, so we've seen, I mean, in total, the first quarter, we've got 120-something complaints.
Cases that our code enforcement have been addressing, yes, sir.
Okay.
So what was on the first page again? So that these do not correlate. Livability on that first page is not livability on
them. Correct. The livability on the first page are calls called into dispatch, and we're still trying to make sure that we are recording from dispatch. It's hard for us to manage what dispatch reports because they're not ours. They're their own entity. So it may be as simple as maybe we take it off of that first page so that it doesn't give a misleading direction that there's nothing, because we do have livability calls that are coming in. Does that make sense?
Yeah, should we be looking at the 120 broken out by what they are? Wouldn't that be more useful, I think, for us to take a look at? Or?
So you would like the bottom graph to match the top?
Does that represent all of the livability complaints, regardless of where they're coming?
Correct.
Including dispatch.
Correct. These are all what you're seeing on the livability page, and that is exactly what our livability officer, our code enforcement officer, worked on himself. That were either emailed to him. He gets a lot of complaints emailed to him, and so he addresses those. They don't go to dispatch that way. So he goes out and is proactive on some of these. Some of these are emails. Some are phone calls that go direct to him, and that's why. So I think this page is more important. What we'll do is remove livability from the front page, period, so that you can focus solely on this page.
Well, I guess the question I'd have too then, are these all in the activity summary, are these all calls from dispatch that we may not be capturing all the calls, or are we capturing all the calls in all the other categories?
On the front page that you're seeing activity summary, those are all the calls that are coming into dispatch.
Okay, so like I'm just using an example. So bicycle stops are zero. Is that if we didn't get them all in dispatch, then?
That means the officer didn't call out a bicycle stop.
Okay.
Because all of our stops, our self-initiated stops for police officers, traffic stops, have to be recorded through dispatch for safety purposes.
Yeah.
So they would call it out as a golf cart stop, a bicycle stop, a pedestrian stop. And then we're relying on dispatch to code it in that way. So there is some room there that maybe it didn't get coded properly. Our channel does tend to be the channel for training new dispatchers. So there's always that possibility.
Okay. So that's a clear delineation you can make is on the first table. Somewhere put livability calls to dispatch,
and yes,
then down below the livability report that you have, I didn't see a date for what time period you were using for those.
For which one?
The livability statistics, page 13.
That will all be for February.
Okay.
Every time you get it, we're like in March, you're going to get February, and April, you'll get March. That way, you get accurate information for the whole month previous.
Okay, so make sure under livability statistics you put the date in February 2023 in the heading. And then down below, livability complaint by property type, that looks like it's the first quarter, it's not just February.
Correct, yes, ma'am.
So
that's a cumulative total for the first quarter. So
that's correct, yes, sir.
And then the livability statistics, page 13, that's a monthly report that our code enforcement officer is accounting for.
Yes, sir. That's correct. Yes, sir.
Okay. So, for example, for February, short-term rental occupancy violations are zero.
Correct.
Okay.
We had a total of 29 complaints in February and 33 complaint distributions. So, again, disposition. So you had some double citations?
Correct, yes, ma'am. There might be, sometimes he might find a business once that doesn't have a business license, write him a ticket. He might have to go back, and they still don't have a business license, so then they get another ticket. The same thing if we have a loud noise complaint, he might write it one time. He might have to go back a second time and write an additional ticket. Or trash can violations.
Okay, so that's follow-up.
Correct, yes,
ma'am. Yeah.
Or it could be multiple violations in one stop. Maybe they didn't have a business license and they were operating something else that they were not supposed to be.
Okay. So I think if you just put different headings, just a little bit more in the heading, you might clarify most of our questions.
Sure. I can take care of that.
Thank you.
Yes.
Next item, strategic plan, policy initiatives, and priorities. Item A, livability. Discussion of short-term rental-related policies and regulations to address livability. In your packet, you've got a one-page sheet that staff had prepared, I guess, Douglas, maybe 30 days or so ago, focused on enforcement and livability issues. Do you want to walk through that?
Yeah, yes, thank you, Mayor. So I would just generally say that through the process of discussing short-term rentals, having the workshops at the rec center, it became very apparent to the staff that stepping up enforcement was a priority for the community. We also, as we kind of compared and talked to other communities, picked up ideas and things that we thought would be worthy of you all considering. So this is a short sheet of things for your consideration, and I would say that you can kind of put each of these in a different bucket. Some are really just administrative, I would say, and at the end of the list, there's some administrative things that my office could do as we process applications. There's fees, which you all obviously set by ordinance, primarily just a financial consideration of what to do. And then those kind of bullets in the middle, I would classify those as policy changes that, you know, you may want to think about having the Planning Commission weigh in, or you may be ready to take action on those already. But if you all, for our purposes, for the staff's purposes, if you could eliminate some, if you see some that you know that you don't like and are kind of dead on arrival, if you could identify those for us, that would be helpful. Otherwise, if you seem interested in them, the staff would go back and just kind of take next steps and come up with a plan of how to implement each of these. So the first bullet there is basically a financial component that the staff feels like to take additional steps in terms of enforcement and compliance and analysis, we would need some additional personnel. We think that could be done with an increase in the fees of $200 per license. We also think that we could use up to three additional staff people. One is kind of specifically in your packet tonight to look at that job description. That's the short-term rental compliance coordinator. We also think that a more financial analyst would be a good piece of personnel to have in place for things like reconciling the various fees that are paid to different agencies. We are not doing that at a really granular level at this time, and we think that we could. And then this additional code enforcement officer that you all have really already kind of dealt with having that role become a full-time instead of a part-time position. So we have there a suggestion of considering an additional $200 fee with each business license. The next, like I said,
before you go, what is the business license cost now?
It is $300. There is a base fee of $350 that covers your first $2,000 worth of rental income. Then there is a set fee of $4.60 per thousand over $2,000. So the more it makes, the higher the. It's not a set fee. It's based on the revenue collected. So this would be an additional $200. We've talked about it either being an application fee, which is the way building permits work. When you apply, you pay a fee basically for the review of that and the consideration of that, or it could be added to the base fee. So that can be done really either way. It can be handled either way.
The difference between one and the other, base fee is paid every year?
Base fee is paid only when you acquire your license. So here recently we had maybe 30, 40 properties or so that made application, but they never completed the process to get a license. So they filed it. We did all the processing, and then it never got issued because the final check didn't come in, so it was never issued. So that would be a way of doing that with just a submittal fee. That would be if it was a submittal fee. The other way would just be to add it to the increase $350 to $550.
And they would pay it every year?
Yes, it's paid every year. One, if it's a submittal fee, it's causing additional transactions for my office. I mean, right now there's an invoice created, a bill sent, a payment made. There's a little bit additional work with doing it as a separate fee. The other one, there's not any additional work, but you only get that fee if they choose to pay for the license. If they submit it, it gets processed and they never pay it. We've done a fair amount of work and do not get paid for that.
So you don't have an application fee at all?
That's what this would be. That's correct. The $200 could either be an application fee.
If you're going to be making hires, I would rather it be a steady stream of income rather than hit and miss. If, I mean, depending upon what happens with the cap, you know, there may not be any turnover in licenses in the future. Who knows?
Right.
So,
either way, you have a steady revenue stream,
right,
whatever you want to call it, right. $200 per license.
Yeah, there's a benefit and a cost with how it's administered. One is more transactions. One is some guaranteed transactions.
So right now, if I wanted to get a short-term rental license for my home, it would cost me $350.
As long as you did...
And I don't rent it at all. It's still $350 a year.
That's correct. If you made more than $2,000 of income, you'd pay $4.60 for every $1,000 over two.
And with this going forward, if I wanted to do the same thing to the same home, it would cost me the proposal here $550.
That's
correct. Because of the application fee.
That's correct.
Okay.
And again, this staff felt like if there was going to be additional personnel, this would be a way to cover some of that.
When was the last time fees have been adjusted?
It has not been that long ago. I think it was 2018. Yeah, they were. That's right. I think they were doubled in 2018. Folly Beach just considerably increased theirs. I think we were among the higher. Folly Beach has really gone way up here recently. We're still in the same area of cost, but maybe not the highest anymore.
I'm good.
Hey, Kevin, can you put yourself on mute?
Yes, okay.
You don't have to call. Yeah, so Dennis, we were 175 in 2018.
Just move the mic away, Mark.
Yes, that's correct. 175 and 230 in 2018.
Right. Hey, Kevin, are you back? Can you put yourself on mute? Do you mind?
Yes, sir.
Please. Thank you.
Okay. Next thing for consideration, this is limit occupancy of newly constructed or substantially reconstructed homes. Right now, there is a limit on a brand new house that's never had a license set at 12. The code does allow, though, high occupancy rentals to be torn down, rebuilt at their same occupancy. If council felt like that was a consideration, you could something you would like to consider. Other communities do it such that if you tear it down, build new, you would come back to the 12 or some other number. And that was the Planning Commission also talked about that, and that was part of what they recommended to you all, was to consider a provision such as that. The third bullet down, require a minimum night stay. Right now, there's no minimum night stay, so you could rent for just one night. There's been the kind of a theory that people who show up for one or two nights are not going to be typically a family, that they would be more of a group interested in having a big time for their 2 days. I do know that the Planning Commission considered this in, not this last go-round, but the round prior to that in 2019, and the feeling at that time was that that would potentially hurt the shoulder months, that there are shorter stays and things like Sealy weekend, when people are not, kids are not out for a full week. So I know that that would be a consideration with extending those minimum night stays, but it's something that you all can look at.
What were they looking at? Were they looking at 2 or 3 night stays? Or?
Yes. Yeah. I think that would be not a week, but something more than
less,
a day.
So
how would you enforce that?
It would have to be, you know, a lot of these things are, we only can enforce what we're aware of happening. Not positive that Rentalscape or Granicus could alert us to that, but we could certainly, we would be able to see the listings, see if it's being marketed for any less than that, which is quite frankly the same way we police occupancy. We're looking at listings to determine if it's being marketed as what it should be, but you know, if more people than it's marketed for show up, we would really only know in a reactive, you know, get a call and react to a situation.
Douglas, on that point, how would you differentiate? I'm sorry. How would you differentiate the old hotels that are now condo hotels? They are set up for nightly rentals. How would you differentiate those? How would I have to do that within the short-term rental license basket?
Yeah, the hotel, so I mean, I think that would be a zoning district. We'd have to differentiate by zoning district. It would be my suggestion that this would not apply in a commercial district or.
So you would go back and apply the 4 zones that the.
Well, it wouldn't be, it would be our traditional, just the commercial district is between 10th and 14th. You would just apply those traditional. Zoning districts.
Okay. And do you have any recommendation on how to limit what a minimum number of stays would be?
I think it would be 2 or 3 days. But I would think if this is something that council wants to consider, my suggestion would be to have the Planning Commission analyze this, because they did it before. They there were concerns raised. So I think they would be well suited to try to work through those details.
Was it the initial thinking that the one night stays were really the major root cause of the concerns? Yeah.
I think so. Yeah. I think the key to this would be asking, kind of reaching out to the people in the business and seeing if 2-3 nights would be detrimental to, you know, would it be too detrimental to consider, but is it something that they, I get the sense that they may not do one night. A lot of them don't do one nights anyway, I don't think, but something we would want to look at closer. Ready for the next one?
Yes.
Amend parking requirements to incentivize less vehicles and more carpooling. This is something that's currently on the Public Safety Committee's agenda, could stay there, could also be looked at by the Planning Commission. And I will just be honest with this, that the problem here has always been if you limit what can be on the property, the kind of immediate solution to that for people who come is to put them in public parking spaces. So you kind of move the problem from being on the property to in public spaces, which has its own set of problems. So this is one that also should be carefully analyzed and considered to not create a different unintended problem.
Is that also a challenge to enforceability because of the difference between the daytime occupancy and the evening occupancy? And I see the chief nodding his head like that. I'm just wondering, if we chase this, is it really worth bothering?
Yes.
Chief, do you have any thoughts on that?
I'm just going to sit up here next. It is difficult for us to enforce. So a lot of the ones we run into that are difficult to enforce deal with the vehicles in the driveway. where you have to have this mathematical formula of how many bedrooms are there, how many people are there, because you can have so many vehicles for over 2.5 people or something along those lines. Then that's a difficult one to enforce. And then what we typically get when we get a call about that, it's a daytime phone call. And they don't realize that the occupancy rate doesn't kick in until overnight. And so at overnight, what we do is we tell them they can't be there, and then where do they go? Into the right-of-ways. And even in your residential parking districts, after 9 o'clock or after 6 o'clock, anybody can park in the residential parking spots. And that's where they go. And then we get complaints about that part. The other part we struggle with these would be the occupancy rate inside, because we don't go door-to-door knocking to count how many people are in a house, and I feel that that would be a violation of somebody's Fourth Amendment right to do so without a cause, and I'm hesitant for that one. I do have concerns with the one that was listed earlier about the number of nights listed. The only way we would enforce that would be just like what we're doing with occupancy rate, as Mr. Carr said earlier, we have to look at the website, and if they're advertising it, that's where we're catching it. Aside from that, we're not going to know one way or the other if they've been there 3 nights, 2 nights, 4 nights, 1 night, because we just don't have the resources, personnel-wise or equipment-wise, to check that with those businesses.
Okay, next one on the list is require short-term rental listings to include the license number. This is something that the city of Charleston does. They do this to, it's really just kind of an outward-facing tool that anybody browsing the internet, including my office or a neighbor, would be able to tell when they look at a listing, you know, is this listing legal? Does it have the proper credentials? So it's just kind of an outward seal of approval, so to speak, that lets the world see that they have the proper credentials to rent.
And Doug, I thought this one was looked at by the Planning Commission, I think, in 19 as well, right?
Yeah.
And it did make the final cut.
It did not, yeah. Correct.
Is there any reason why it wouldn't?
The primary reason is that our primary tool for identifying illegal short-term rentals is the software that we use. Basically, if that software shows it to us as being a rental, that's our tool of knowing that it's illegal or legal, regardless of whether or not they have a picture on the listing. So from our standpoint, from an enforcement standpoint, we would be using the software tools to know if something was illegal or legal. So it's creating, and we've talked about creating, you know, kind of rules that at the end of the day aren't going to be utilized by really anybody other than kind of a feel good. The neighbors could see it, and it gives them some assurance. We wouldn't really be using that as an enforcement tool. We would be relying on software to do that. So I think that's the reason. Next one is require short-term rental applicants to be considered for a special exception by the Board of Zoning Appeals. This is one that we're borrowing from Charleston County. This is how they handle their short-term rentals. Kind of a warning on this one would be really the council would have, and I would say with the Planning Commission, would have to develop standards that would give BOZA the ability to deny one and approve another one. If you had today's code and you just added the requirement for a special exception, it would be very much a rubber stamp approval. But if there was some kind of differentiating factor that you wanted the Board of Zoning Appeals to consider, you know, it could be something like how many are on the block, how many are on a street. I can't think of them off the top of my head, but you would have to create new criteria for the Board of Zoning Appeals to consider, and those criteria would be put into the code. But that is how Charleston County does it currently. Something to consider. Last one there. This is really process, and all of these below the last bullet our process and application requirements. These were, I think these were all taken from the town of Mount Pleasant. They have a pretty, they have a considerable kind of application process. And I would say that later in your agenda, you're talking about a short-term rental coordinator. I don't think that these things could be done with our current staff. I mean, if it was the will of council to bolster the requirements and things that my office is looking at when we're issuing these licenses, I think you'd have to do that knowing that it would take additional manpower. One of these, that in the first one on the list, is a fire safety checklist. And I, this is something that the building department has already developed along with the fire department. It's in your packet for your review. Most of these are already requirements. They're in the fire code. They're an existing set of criteria. There's also on there recommendations, and those recommendations are taken at the suggestion of the fire department. The building department has already put this, we actually put this out with the application last week. We pretty instantly heard some resistance to the idea, so we've paused requiring this for the time being until you all had a chance to look at it, consider it. We don't think these are new policies. We think these are existing policies. But I think the concern was really the timing. We're really in renewal time now, and this new form went out last week just ahead of expecting people to renew their application in the next couple of months. So fire department thought that a 90-day grace period would be appropriate, and that's been included into the form, that if you sign that these things are taken care of, you're acknowledging that you'll have any deficiencies rectified within 90 days. It may be that even the 90-day grace period may need to be lengthened, because I think there's still concerns.
Is it a concern about compliance, or is it a concern about the representation, or is it a concern, what is the major concern here?
I think the primary concern is those agencies that have hundreds of units, and they're kind of, you know, I think it's kind of a commitment of fixing the unknown in 3 months in a busy time already for them. So I don't know that any of these, and if you read the list, I don't think any of them are, you know, punitive or would take a lot of money or a lot of time. So I think that it's just the giving them the time to go through, you know, in some cases, several hundred rental units to be sure that all of them have everything that they need. So if the group is agreeable but wants to give 6 months or delay for a year, whatever you think is best. But I think that we felt like if we didn't do it now, we basically would not have this in place for another year. And again, we thought it was probably stuff that was all being done already, but maybe it's not.
I think this is something that the staff needs to determine themselves, because you know the manpower and you know the regulations. You could give exceptions to the ones with a large number of units to give them more time, but I don't think that's something council needs to decide for you.
And I have a couple questions. Go ahead. Are these recommendations, or are these building code regulations, or are they a combination of both, and who decided?
It's a combination of both. And they, who decided to incorporate it into the application?
Yeah.
It was a joint decision between the fire department and the building department.
Because the application clearly states twice these pretty strong language called compliance.
Right.
It says compliance. And at the end it said, under, it's just like signing a tax return under, just about under penalty of perjury. We're in compliance. And so, I mean, a lot of things are
Would this be recommended in my house? I don't have a short-term rental. And if so, what's the difference between if I had a short-term rental license and I rented my house for 3 weeks, a year, I would have to go through all of these steps to sign off on this form that says I'm in compliance?
So, to get to your first question, there is a mixture there of several of them are shalls. I mean, several of them are requirements, and then the others are recommendations. But each bullet either includes a shall or a recommendation. So it's a mix of the two. And I guess, yes, to get to your question of if you chose to rent your house on
for a
few weeks, the expectation would be that you would do each of these things.
I guess I have a question to the chief. If we're not compliant, if somebody is not compliant with these items, I don't know if they're that rigorous or not rigorous, would that indicate that potentially you have people coming into a home that may not be safe from a fire or other safety protection, which I think I would expect if I were renting a home?
When you finish, chief, I have other questions. I wasn't finished yet.
I can wait until you...
Good, you know, you speak. But, I mean, some of them just seems... Like, well, I understand circuit breaker has to be closed and there can't be any unused circuits. I mean, I don't have to worry about that in my house right now. And that the fire extinguisher must be 60 inches above the floor just outside of the kitchen. You have some of these multi-million dollar houses that maybe they like to put the fire extinguisher under the sink. But I'm just wondering if maybe one path to consider is just have compliance issues and then have another section of recommendations.
Yeah. So not have them commingled in
right.
the form.
Right.
These are
yeah.
what you have to do. These are what we recommend. I think we could certainly
like
do
smoke that. Detectors in every room, smoke detectors. And there's even a provision for a carbon monoxide detector. I don't have one in my house.
Yeah,
pretty standard.
I mean, a lot of these are just the current building code, and if you're going to be renting, you should probably be following the current.
Well, my point is, it's a mixture of compliance and recommendations, and I'd like to see it broken out. What is in compliance and what is recommended?
Yeah, I think we can certainly, you know, the way it's done now is by grouping. Fire protection, general, electrical, heating. But some are shalls, some are recommendations, but we can certainly pull out those that are requirements and those that are recommendations. That wouldn't be a problem.
Okay. Thank you, sir. Go ahead, Chief. Thank you.
Absolutely. So we, in the four that are required, what we did is we went back and did our due diligence to make sure we're getting it all correct. But for the extinguisher, that is South Carolina Fire Code Section 906, and it shall be serviced and tagged every 6 years. The top of the extinguisher should be no higher than 60 inches, you know, 5 feet from the floor, so you can put it at a level that's appropriate, and mounted in a conspicuous location where they'll have ready access to be immediately available. So we went back and amended the form, so I don't know if the forms that you have in your possession now are the updated ones, if they reflect the 90 days. When we initially rolled this out, we got really good feedback from the individual renters, but with the larger rental companies, obviously it's more of a struggle. So we realized that, you know, I realized I made a mistake and rolled this out, recommended to roll it out too quickly. We need to give people time to, you know, make these changes. But there are four requirements, and so the fire extinguisher is one. The working smoke alarms in each bedroom and hallways outside all sleeping spaces and on each floor. That's South Carolina Residential Code Section R314 and South Carolina Fire Code 1103-8. And carbon monoxide detectors, one located on each floor, is a residential code as well, R315 and South Carolina Fire Code 1103.9.
So like a standalone smoke detector is $20. You can get a combination smoke and carbon monoxide for $34. The fire extinguisher is $25. And the carbon monoxide is $25, which they make them now where you can just, you know, plug them into an outlet. They're, you know, low footprint type of device. And then the fourth piece was the dwelling street address, which it is difficult for us as we respond to make sure we're going to the right house, especially at night or inclement weather. So having that standardized as per residential, South Carolina residential code R319 about the conspicuous location, doesn't say where it has to be, but just conspicuous, with the numbers and letters should be 4 inches in height or greater. So those are the four big hitters that are required. The remainder are recommendations, and those recommendations are based upon fire code best practice. And, you know, the big thing for us is we want to be proactive. We want to help our business owners, whether they're short-term renters, whether they're a commercial occupancy, protect their investment. And we know it's tough on restaurants to do the hood cleaning maintenance. We know it's tough for a business owner as we roll out these things that they do have a cost associated with them. And some people may not be able to install these. But we want to be proactive and minimize and mitigate the risk to the guests and also to protect that short-term renter, the owner. So if they have early detection in place, if they have fire extinguishment capability in place, that helps the occupant and definitely helps the owner. And we did this with support of the fire code. We looked also at neighboring municipalities throughout the state, and we're one of the few right now that we do not have currently any requirements for fire and life safety. So we took a very soft approach and tried to roll it out, but again, my mistake, and I apologize for rolling it out a little too quickly and without a grace period and a time associated with that, so people could come into compliance. And we're also in that 90-day frame. You know, we are not going to go out. We don't have the staff, as you know, Chief Cornett mentioned, you know, for his piece, but we don't have the staff, and it is not our intention to go out to a short-term rental to inspect. That is not what we want to do. We want to educate the owner and have them make that a safe place in a standardized format based upon code, and we're giving them that time frame to do it, and they're signing that they recognize that these are recommendations and requirements, but we are not going to go out and inspect these occupancies. We don't have the staff, and we don't have the we don't feel it's the right thing to do for our fire department. Currently, the council directs otherwise, and we can review that.
So, Douglas, just to be clear, pause this. This is not a requirement. You feel like your staff is clear to somebody's coming in for a short-term rental license today. We're not looking for this unless they just want to volunteer at this point.
We were looking for it.
Right. But to say, as of now, we're paused, taking a deep breath. I mean, I think, Chief, to your point, I appreciate you saying, I mean, to not have our rental management folks weighing in is a big mess. I mean, we got to have that.
We did speak to them, some of the companies, through, and then as we rolled out the form, we got a lot of really good feedback. We made some initial adjustments. Gotcha. To Mr. Buchanan's point, sent an email to me earlier today about, you know, representing the Isle of Palms Chamber of Commerce. And so we did miss as a fire department on making sure all our stakeholders were involved. But this didn't have anything to do with the updated code, the updated fire code. It had zero to do with that. It had to do with us not having anything in place as a municipality to mitigate our risk and to mitigate the risk to the people who are in a short-term rental. And again, these changes, you know, we wanted to make sure that we have costs associated with that. What are we asking people to do? And these are things that can be done very easily and very inexpensive on your own, but for a large company that has multiple properties under their umbrella with the occupancy rates, it can be difficult. So we definitely are solid on these recommendations, but I'm all about extending that time frame. We definitely want to roll that form out if we can, but if it's 120 days or whatever council views is fair and appropriate, and talking with, you know, Chamber of Commerce, we can have those conversations, but we definitely feel it's needed.
Mr. Mayor, I'd like to recommend that this go. The Public Safety Committee has not reviewed this, and it would be a good point for us to send this back to Public Safety and for us to work with the fire department in getting it back to a format that we can just bring back to council for approval.
Yeah, and I might take it a step further. I mean, everything Douglas and staff has prepared on this list are worthy of conversation, but I might ask to go to the Planning Commission to come back with recommendations.
Yeah.
You know, the only one that, and I'll just speak for myself, you know, from my viewpoint, the only one that causes me heart burn is the BOZA process. I mean, that feels bureaucratic to me. And 1,700, whatever license we wind up with, that's a lot to put on a very small volunteer committee.
And then how about the financial aspect of it? That, I mean, I would say that's really that's a consideration for you all more than the Planning Commission. You okay with not giving them that? Let you all work on that.
I was going to suggest that same thing. I don't think the Planning Commission needs to entertain anything with the financial side of it, which is the first bullet point.
Right.
And I question whether they do on the second, the last one rather, which is the is revamp the application process. That's really not a Planning Commission. I don't think function to look at that. I think the middle one's all. I do think that's probably a good place for it to go to.
Yeah, I just had one question. It sounds like there's a sense that this is a right thing to do, a good thing to do for the safety of everybody. It's just going out in the implementation and coordinating it with the rental community.
Yeah.
It's got to be worked on. But I mean, this that's on this list and the four items seem like they'd be a good direction for us to go into over the next couple of seasons. Just got to work on implementation.
Yeah, I would just add to that there was a sense of urgency to try to capture this year's pool of rentals. I do think if we, you know, if it starts down a path of committee and council, and we will basically miss this year, but we haven't had it other years. So if the group
or miss this year,
yeah. So if we think we're kind of okay with the idea of missing this year, then I don't think there's any harm in putting it through.
This request went out to all the short-term rental license holders, though, right?
It may have just gone to the major managers. I'm not sure that we.
No, it went to a neighbor of mine.
We just had one.
I know of one.
Okay.
Maybe it did. And they decided not to renew their license anyway, since we don't have caps. But they declined to do the form because of that. So it's going out to some individual SDR license holders.
You know more than I do, Rusty. You know, you got the distribution list.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just had one. I hate to drag things out, but if you wouldn't mind a little bit more information about why you decided not to include the rental license number as public information. It's just that your software takes care of it?
Yes. Yeah, we identify. So I think the thought there would be if you see a listing that doesn't have that, you would know, you know, that's a non-compliant property, we're going to pursue that. We would just never do it that way. We would always use, and quite frankly, if it doesn't have that number and they're renting illegally, they're not going to give you their address, so you're not going to be able to find it anyway. So you kind of have to go back to the compliance software to identify that property anyway. So it could certainly be done as kind of a feel-good thing for, again, neighbors looking at listings, but we would not be using it as a real enforcement tool.
Okay, so that's mainly internal management tool. Well, I know that, you know, there's a lot of licensing boards in the state of South Carolina, and if you would like to say that you're, let's say, a CPA, then you go to South Carolina Board of Accountancy and look up, see if there is a number attached to that name that you're licensed in the state, as well as a doctor or architect or whatever. And so as far as the general public, as far as their faith in the system, I don't see the problem with it, but I'm going to leave it to you guys. But I do know that people can get general license information for different professions.
Yeah, we certainly provide you know, license information on every property to anybody who asks for it. So it's not going to provide. We just, and we're, you know, I guess we would say we're indifferent about it. We're not going to use it, but if if council feels
that time.
What's that?
Why are we asking for
it? I think that's why it was taken off the list last time.
All right, this is going back to planning commission, so we're good. Okay. Chief, thank you all. Douglas and staff, thank you for putting all that together. Item B, environmental, we don't have anything. C, public services, first item, discussion of paramedic program. I know Chief Olivares has talked to the public safety committee about this. You've got a presentation in your packet. So Chief, we'll let you take it away.
I appreciate this opportunity, you know, on behalf of, you know, our fire department and our residents and you as we navigate this together and explore this opportunity. And some of the questions that you may have at the end, I may not be able to answer, and I'll have to research and get some of that information back to you, but hopefully I can answer, you know, the lion's share of any questions that you may have. And then before we start, I know this this request will be it's a large financial request, and in our strategic plan, the 2022 to 2027 strategic plan, it notes, you know, financial sustainability. It notes a resilient community, and both of those go hand in hand. And in the fire department, you know, since I arrived, we've looked at different ways with our deployment model, different things we can do to optimize our level of service, but also reduce our footprint budgetarily. How can we marry those things up? And so that's an active piece as we roll through, and we're going to shortly be rolling out a survey to the community in conjunction with College of Charleston as we develop our strategic plan and getting the feedback from our stakeholders, so we do it in a measured way and we don't make the missteps, you know, like I did with the short-term rental, because I was, you know, ready to get that rolling and saw some risk for us, and I wanted to mitigate that. So, you know, again, you know, lesson learned, but this is why we're doing what we're doing here with the presentation. So this is a large financial hit, you know, to the budget, but we believe, you know, the juice is worth the squeeze. And we would not be asking for council to consider this and explore it if we didn't feel that it was needed and we didn't feel that it was worthwhile. And as your fire chief, I want to make sure that we're giving you the information that you need so you can weigh those and make the informed decisions on what you feel is best for the community. And, of course, we support your decision. So we know Isle of Palms and the Lowcountry region, you know, we're definitely growing. What we are today is what we are not, you know, going to be tomorrow. If somebody moves into Berkeley County, we still are going to see them here at Isle of Palms. If they move into Dorchester County, we're still going to see them here at Isle of Palms when they come to the beach. There's so much, and there's a finite amount of beach that's available and readily and easily accessible. So as time grows, we predict that our call volume will grow in the fire department. We could predict that the demand for city services will increase, and you've all seen that in your tenure here, and then as you've, you know, lived on the island as a resident. So 30 people a day, you know, moving into Charleston by the Charleston Regional Developmental Alliance. And in your packet, you know, you have a lot of this information with the demographics. An aging population is predicted. The aging population is more at risk and have a greater need for advanced life support, which is paramedic level care. This is very important. A statistic we pulled by compiling the information from Charleston County. From their dispatch center, they send us a monthly report on response times. And so our response times are, you know, 6 minutes and 53 seconds from the time that somebody dials 911 and is picked up at dispatch for the time for an Isle of Palms fire and rescue apparatus to arrive on scene. That's our typical, our average. For Charleston County EMS, the average is much higher, 14 minutes and 23 seconds. Some months, as we looked at different months, some were 18 minutes, 19 minutes, some months were 10 minutes. But it averaged out over time. We were looking at, you know, 14 and a half minutes.
And that's to the Isle of Palms.
Correct.
EMS. It's not the general, their overall response time. It's for the Isle of Palms.
That's correct. These are the City of Isle of Palms response times. These are ours.
No, I'm talking about the Charleston County EMS.
Yes. For Charleston County EMS to arrive on scene here at Isle of Palms. Okay. Yeah. Yep, that's 14 minutes and 23 seconds.
That's the ambulance coming to us.
That's an ambulance or a Delta unit, which is their SUV with one paramedic supervisor on that unit. It could be either. And it could also be an ambulance that is basic life support and not a paramedic level ambulance, but it is a Charleston County EMS unit. So our options, we were tasked with looking at to try to give you a good picture and see where we go from here. Looked at a third party because we do know that staffing costs grow over time, and sometimes when you outsource, it can be good for an operational model in the private sector or public sector. So we looked at that. We talked to Port City Ambulance, and we also reviewed our internal operations. How could we deliver that elite customer service and do the same thing internally? So we talked to Port City and we got a quote on what would it take for an SUV to be outfitted with a paramedic and then a paramedic on an ambulance with a EMT basic. They broke down their costs. They forecasted that they would receive about $150,000 in revenue from the patients that they would transport to the hospital. There are quite a few challenges with a third party. A third party we found has been successful for things like the Bridge Run, Isle of Palms Connector Run, different things to where we have, if we have an acute event over a specific period of time, a short window, and we have a municipal operations center up, it works really, really well. What the challenge would be with a third party is if someone called Charleston County 911, they call 911, the 911 center answers that call, and they direct that call to the appropriate resource. A Port City Ambulance is not on that call loop, so what would happen is Charleston County, like if we had a Port City Ambulance here and it was contracted, let's say it's July 8th in the summertime, they would receive a call, Charleston County would dispatch, they would call actually Port City on the phone, or they would call me a radio and say, hey, you have a call at 123 ABC Lane, and this is the call, this is the information, and Port City would then get that information, and then they would turn around and dispatch the unit themselves. So there is a period of time that we would lose, we feel that our response times would suffer. The ambulance would be here on the island, which would be a great thing, but we just looked at one ambulance and one SUV. So there's a host of different challenges. Some we can work through, some would be very difficult. Some would require us still to respond as the fire department. So the efficiency here is lost in, if we have direct hire firefighter medics, they can respond to 100% of our call volume. If it is a Port City paramedic, they can respond to 47 or 50% of our call volume. So if we spend the money to hire Port City, let's say for 1 year, at $761,000, they're not responding to all our calls, our vehicle accidents. They can respond medically, but like our water rescues, if it's non-medical in nature, for fires, all those other things that we respond to, they're not able to respond to those call types and assist. So that is one detractor on that model.
Chief, if you could, I know what you're talking about very well because we've already gone through this with public safety. A lot of people don't. If you could just very quickly say where we are today, if somebody on 40th Avenue has a heart attack today, what happens with our services versus what would happen if a paramedic was available? What's the difference?
Okay.
That's the big issue. What are we getting for our money? So what's the difference? If I'm having a heart attack, do I want a paralegal to show up or a paralegal later? Or am I okay with just the fire department coming? What's the difference?
Okay, great question. So cardiac arrest call for service was dispatched. We would send our battalion chief and two fire department units. So they're immediately going to get seven people on scene, one in a command role and the other six to do the interventions. And we would have an AED, an automatic external defibrillator. So if that patient was in a systole, which is a flat line, if they were in VFib, which is ventricular fibrillation, or ventricular tachycardia, those are three shockable rhythms, then we could shock that individual with or defibrillate their heart with an AED. And so we would arrive, we would assess the patient, perform, you know, hands CPR, keep the blood moving, apply the AED. Do the pads show shock indicated, yes or no? Paramedic arrives. If the rhythm is in different states, they have the ability to manually defibrillate or do synchronized cardioversion for the patient. And so if they're in a unique rhythm, like torsades to points or all these other things, paramedic has that ability to, with pre-hospital medicine, all the advances, they're able to perform an intervention. They can also give amiodarone, epinephrine, all these cardiac medications that are great for the patient. So we had a cardiac arrest recently at the boathouse, and there was a physician on scene. And so our guys and girls did great. We did everything we could. And once we had stabilized the patient, he was like, okay, let's get, you know, epinephrine on board, let's get amiodarone. And we said, hey, we don't have that. We don't have those medications. Charleston County EMS does. So we had got to the patient to a point to where we could no longer provide additional therapeutic care because they were above our scope. A paramedic, we can intubate with an endotracheal tube. We can do pleural decompression if it's a traumatic arrest, if the arrest is caused by trauma. We can do those things, a paramedic. The medications that can be delivered through the bone. It can be delivered through the vein. Can be delivered through the muscle. So that's a big thing. Allergic reactions, pain management, it's just such at a higher level now than it used to be. And the supportive care with pain management, we have a lot of falls here at Isle of Palms, and so if somebody has a fractured hip, getting that pain management on board is really, really important to help stabilize the patient, and it's the humane thing to do, but also helps us package the patient and get them out of a weird situation, because typically they will fall down the steps or they fall in an awkward place and we have to move them manually and it can be more painful. So we can have everything ready to go. If we have paramedics here, we can do everything Charleston County EMS could do. And when they arrived, they'd be packaged and we could just load them up into the ambulance. And if they needed an additional paramedic, for example, now Charleston County EMS is moving to a model because of their service demand where they have an EMT basic ambulance. And so we provide currently an EMT basic service, which, you know, we can, for allergic reaction, we can do an EpiPen, you know, we can do these minor things with Narcan. But Charleston County EMS, if we can load that patient up, we can turn that into an ALS ambulance because our paramedic can hop on that ambulance and we have all the ALS equipment and there's no delay on us waiting on an ALS ambulance, a paramedic level ambulance, to come to our location. We can utilize that basic ambulance. So the downside to that is our firefighter rides to the hospital, but currently we kind of do the same thing. What we do is we drive that ambulance to the hospital, so the cardiac arrest at the boathouse to get that patient where they needed to be and to get EMS in the back of the ambulance. Our firefighter drove to the hospital, and our battalion chief went and picked them up. So the model would change a little bit. We could have a paramedic in the back giving supportive care to that patient. So those are kind of the main differences. But there are about 30 to 36 different procedures that could be done if you're a paramedic compared to EMT basic.
Thank you, Chief. And those extra services become magnified in importance if we got traffic issues and you can't get somebody to the hospital, correct?
Yes, sir. Absolutely.
Thank you.
So we have three different options. You'll see option one, two, and three. Option one, we have the addition of seven personnel, and because we would be looking at a new operational model, we have a operations chief listed. Six firefighter paramedics, which would be two firefighter paramedics per shift. But we would be asking for seven people to make option one feasible.
This is all internal, right?
Correct. Yes, ma'am.
Okay. So yeah. The contract services you've completed, and now we're talking about three options that we could use.
A contract will be option three. Okay. And then we'll compare all three, like heads up, where they'll be on the same sheet.
Okay.
It'll be a little easier to see. So total startup cost, just under $1 million. That's a huge ask, and we realize that. So looking at it, you know, we, with Ms. Janice Ladd, we have already put in our documentation for the need for an operations chief. But in our strategic plan, if this is something that could be deferred, the operations chief, this could be in a five-year window with this new operational model. We can make it work, but over time, an operations chief would definitely help us be more efficient.
Yeah, Chief, real quick, just what's in council's packet? This is actually option two in the presentation
okay.
sitting in council.
Okay. Right. Okay, I apologize. We'll get you that updated presentation emailed out to you. And so option two,
six personnel.
I think what's in the packet was what was originally presented to the safety committee.
Yeah.
Yes, that's correct.
Based on our feedback, you've changed it up. Yeah.
That's correct.
Okay.
Yeah, thank
so
you.
You've switched them around.
So which one is now preferred of what you're telling us about now, one, two, or three?
So one is preferred. We can make two work if we had to phase in the operations chief. We can phase it in 12 months or 24 months. But option one is definitely preferred. Option two, the startup cost, year one, $750,000. So a lot less than $960,000, but you know that additional person is the big difference.
But if you go back to that one you were just showing, the startup cost, $150,000, you can actually probably extend that cost over several years for the duration of the equipment, so it's really not... Help me here, Jimmy.
Amortized or depreciated.
Yeah. So it's $600 on a recurring basis and $150 once. $150,000 once is what you're saying with that.
So the $150,000, great question. So $120,000 are for two cardiac monitors. We would replace those every 5 years.
Right. So
five to six.
5 years. Yeah.
And then the $30,000 is to get us up to speed with additional medications and additional equipment. But over time, we forecast a $3,000 to $4,000 annual cost. So in the year five, we would jump back up to $120,000 for the monitors. But that would not be present year two, three, and four.
But we don't need any additional automobiles or...
You don't need a vehicle, right?
Not at this point. I mean, what we're talking about is just having paramedics on staff.
Yeah.
So we have two pickup trucks in order, and we can put the paramedics, we can put them on the pickup truck on the SUV. We can also put them on the fire engine. So we don't need an additional vehicle right now. And then I'll show you in year five what we would do to reduce some of our capital costs to your vehicle question.
So
and
this is
how,
a oh, go ahead, sorry.
So how would this work with our shared would these individuals be leaving the island for a call in Mount Pleasant, or would they be staying?
They would not be leaving unless that's something we wanted to entertain. So right now we currently are running Squad 1001, which is our Freightliner truck. It seats two people, and that is not a shared asset. So that will always be on Isle of Palms. Unless Sullivan's Island or Mount Pleasant or another municipality reached out directly and said, could you send me this specific asset
and then that battalion chief would make the decision on yay or nay, if we're able to or not. And so that builds in some resiliency for us. So that right now is handling our a lot of our medical calls. It's keeping the ladder truck from having to go along with them, so we don't have to send, you know, a less fuel-efficient vehicle and send three people. So they can handle the medical call while the ladder 1001 is available for water rescues, for fire, for vehicle accidents, all those other things. But great point. If we decided down the road to share assets with Mount Pleasant, for example, because they have non-transport paramedics, we could do that automatically. But we like the fact, and we have seen great data from keeping that unit here in service on Isle of Palms, so it's dedicated to us and it's not a shared asset.
So Chief,
can we get Kevin in real quick?
Yeah.
Kevin, go ahead.
Thanks, Mr. Mayor. Chief, just a quick question. Your staffing cost number, is that an all-in number? Salary, benefits, retirement, everything?
Yes, sir. We got with Ms. Suggs on that to make sure that I was doing all my math correctly. So that's daily uniforms, personal protective equipment, retirement, health care, you know, all the fringe benefits, and the salary number.
Yeah, so it's still
all right, so Chief, under this proposal here, this option, you would always have two paramedics on 24/7, basically. Every ship would have at least two. It would have two paramedics.
So one of those. So the reason for two is because most days we would have two, but let's say one paramedic calls out sick. What we could do is we would shut down, you know, the paramedic operations on one station, for example. We would not have to hire overtime, so we wouldn't incur that overtime cost. But it would build in the resiliency to where we have one paramedic available.
Okay, and all paramedics would be fully certified as firefighters also, correct?
That's correct. They would be multi-role.
So the multi-role is not, I'm a paramedic, I don't fight fires.
That's correct. Versa. That's correct. Yes, sir.
The idea of having the vehicle for their use, separate vehicles, they can go to a fire and if they need they get a call for a medical emergency, they can jump in the truck and get there just about as fast as they would coming from the station. So that's the reason for
the option one does have a vehicle, $60,000, correct?
Yes, and that's for the operations chief.
Right.
That's where that vehicle is. Yes, sir.
Right. But if I remember correctly from the public safety presentation, this is just getting the patient ready to go. We would not be transporting them off the island.
That's correct. We would not transport off the island. That's correct.
Right. Great.
But to follow that up, what you were showing before on one of the original slides was it takes us 7 minutes to get to a call, roughly?
Yes, ma'am.
Respond to a call. And it takes the ambulance off island 15 minutes to get here?
14 minutes and 23 seconds average.
Okay.
Yes, ma'am.
I rounded up.
Yeah.
So in that 5 or 6 minutes, our paramedic can stabilize the patient and have that patient ready to be transported as soon as the ambulance arrives. So we're effectively doing everything we can and just have to turn around and send the patient back with the ambulance as soon as it arrives.
Chief, how many certified paramedics do we have on staff now in the department?
One, me.
Okay.
It's about an 18... month commitment, and we have initially we had three people that were interested, and because of that time commitment, now we have, you know, two people that are interested. And there's no guarantee when you the completion of school, it's difficult, you know, from a it's commitment. You spend a lot of time in the hospital, a lot of time on EMS, a lot of time in class, and it's very rigorous, the academic portion. And so for us to do that, you know, we have to reach outside our current staff.
So if we go with one of the options internally here, other than a third party, it will take us quite a long time just to ramp up to have a paramedic program in place that's workable for us, right?
So for us, maybe. Well, if we direct hire paramedics, we feel that our timeline, and that's the very last slide I'll show you. But no, that's fine. We would be ready to go by, I believe, April of next year, if it was approved in July. And we would have the ability, if we hired people who are paramedics but don't have firefighter certification and they want to be firefighters, that's great. We can send them to a recruit school here locally in Mount Pleasant in September. And then they would graduate in February. And then we would do our internal, you know, orientation here in March and be ready to go, you know, almost, you know, this time next year. So 12 months from, you know, today. But if, you know, we know that it's coming and it's approved, you know, we can be pretty nimble and be ready to go if in July the money is ready to go.
Could this be done with our current staffing if they had the certification? Or do we need more people?
So right now, and you'll see this slide, I'll jump ahead to it. So we ran the numbers, and to your point, we are utilizing the staffing factor of 1.25, which means, you know, 10 is our minimum right now. So we technically to have 10 personnel on staff ready to go to do work, we need to have 12.5 people hired. And if we have 12.5 people staffed on the rolls for that shift, two of them can be off without us having to hire overtime. What we're finding now is with the staffing of 10, that when we ran the numbers for unscheduled overtime, and this is very, very rough because we have scheduled overtime that's built into our salaries as firefighters, but all unscheduled overtime, we found that 63% when we did that of that budgeted overtime accounted to $224,000. So to the point about, hey, can we have one paramedic or we have two paramedics? Well, one paramedic can be off. We wouldn't incur the overtime costs because we wouldn't be required to do it. But in order for us to maintain a minimum staffing of 10, only having 10 on staff anytime somebody takes off for training or they are sick or they take off on vacation, we have to backfill their position. So we do feel that using that staffing factor of 1.25, some of this overtime cost, and it's hard to quantify how much, would potentially be reduced. What that number is, I don't know, but with an FTE that we calculated at $100,000, we feel that we could reduce our overtime with having that staffing factor in place. And that's why we're asking for those two personnel per shift to get to the six, which would help potentially with this piece, but also the paramedic piece, the additional new level of service. So I'm just going to forward through all these so we can get to the nitty-gritty of it. And you'll see in year five, option two was six personnel, option one was seven personnel, that it drops dramatically. Well, the reason for that is we currently have an apparatus that we have budgeted to replace in 5 years, and we have $500,000 in our capital plan that would be dedicated to that. We would not have to spend that $500,000. We would spend $60,000 to replace it with a light SUV, a light truck. And so that is the financial sustainability piece that we try to balance with, you know, having this big ask for staffing cost. But operationally, that it actually will get us more efficiency if we're able to do this and reduce our fuel costs, tires, maintenance, all those things, and we can get the SUV down a driveway. So,
and Chief, just
on the beach.
219, that doesn't cover six people.
No, so what we did just to show that is, I know that's a capital cost, but it would be 440 plus the 219 would be the true cost. But if we have the paramedic program, we don't have to replace that $500,000 apparatus. And so we tried to show where we're being fiscally responsible. But yes, to your point, you would add that for...
So my year five cost is $650-ish.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Absolutely.
Wait a minute.
what you're doing is you're taking the apparatus that you replaced, that $500,000 apparatus, is not an ambulance or something that's being used by a paramedic now. That's just something that you're saying we no longer need in our department.
Correct. Correct.
So
our operational.
It's just like the overtime hours that you were shifting from overtime to pay for a paramedic. You can now take funds that would have been used for a vehicle to pay for salaries going forward.
Your five is just showing an incremental cost.
Correct. Correct. The funds would be available for other, you know, things that, because that would be a capital, you know, cost, and that would be for the funds would be available for another project in the city, or it would be freed up because we would not need to replace that vehicle and buy that same piece. Our operational model will have changed where it's no longer needed. This is Port City. And so this is probably one of the more important slides when you're looking at it monetarily. Port City's there, they're in the circle. Their year one cost, and you can see their year two cost. And so we talked to Port City, and what we used is we talked to Ms. Suggs, and we said, hey, you know, over time, so we used 2.5% for merit each year, and then we used 1.5% for health care or retirement. So we increased our cost fire department-wise for non-transport paramedics by 4% each year. And then we did the same with Port City, because when we talked to Port City, we said, okay, if we do this model, what are we looking at? They said, well, the last 2 years with the labor market, they were between 6 and 8% is what they saw in the labor market the last 2 years. They don't anticipate that increase this next year. They anticipate between 3 and 5%. So we used 4% for them as well. They said the only thing that would change their cost other than the labor market or other than inflation would be if the revenue that they gained did not meet their target of $150,000. They said they would pass that cost directly on to us, you know, and onto the municipality. So if they only were able to receive $100,000 in revenue, they would pass that $50,000 on to us at with the next contract renewal.
So what this is, this table here, is the net increase in the fire department budget based on the different options is what this table is.
Correct. Okay. So the year one startup cost, and then this would be the increase to our budget that is currently not there across a five-year window. And what it would be to have Port City give us an ambulance and an SUV across a five-year window, with those variables of their revenue projections and with the variables in the labor market and inflation for goods or medications. Yeah. And then, Mr. Streetman, to follow up on your implementation piece, we got it right there. Those are some of our great-looking people. Super talented.
Sure.
We're done. But that's when we looked at, you know, that September piece when we would send those firefighter paramedics to school if they didn't have paramedic certification, and then they'd be ready to go hitting the street, you know, hitting us, you know, in March or April of next year. So I know it's a lot to digest, and great questions. If you have additional questions, I'd be happy to answer those, or we can talk about it later, but just appreciate you being open and wanting to explore this opportunity to see what we can do to deliver elite customer service over time.
Yes. What's the job market? How hard is it going to be to find these people?
So the job market, so we're actually sitting in a really good spot. We're very attractive from a place to work. Isle of Palms, we have, you know, no assisted living facilities. We have an amazing, beautiful location. The call volume is such where it's rewarding, but they are not putting 300 miles on an ambulance and dealing with the hospital and physicians and then the patient and back and forth. And, you know, you might be in one area in Charleston County and North Charleston, and then you might be in Edisto Beach and then McClellanville, all in the same shift. So those things we have is recruiting tools. The salary piece, we budgeted 15% on top of the starting salary. So, you know, we'll have to see as we go out to market for those positions, but I think we're a very attractive place, and with having to hire six as opposed to, you know, potentially nine, I think we have a unique opportunity.
Yeah, I would just like to say we really appreciate the detailed work you put into this presentation. It's very interesting, and I'm sure the Public Safety Committee will be taking it up every month, and we're going to stay on top of it. I think this is something that's really needed for the island. We've always, over the years, have been concerned about response time for medical emergencies and stuff. But if you remember a few years ago, we had a helicopter service coming, trying to sell us some stuff. That didn't work out. But this is a very, very serious presentation. Is something that really merits consideration, and I'd like to say thank you.
Absolutely.
Yeah, thank you, Chief. I'd like to say thank you also. A couple observations, because I know you did get to at least one slide here with the third party, where there are potential challenges. And if I understand it correctly, you know, if you had a third party, there'd be times the unit would be off island because they'd be transporting patients to the mainland, right?
That's correct, and we might not see them for quite a long time.
Right, so we wouldn't be covered at all during that period of time if something were to happen.
That's correct, and Port City is on the mutual aid with Charleston County, mm-hmm. and so they have a contract, so we might not be able to receive, you know, aid from Port City if an ambulance is off island. And MUSC, you know, they're just like all of us, you know, we're kind of bursting at the seams, and Roper Hospital and all these hospitals, but if you bring a patient in and there's no bed available, you can't just leave them in the hallway. And so there was a call recently to one of our neighbors, and I monitored it, and they had two ambulances that were stuck at the hospital that could not respond to the call. Their patients were stabilized, but a bed was not open. And so you have those, you know, those variables like that that are out of everyone's control. You know, in the fire department, EMS world, when you get to the hospital, you still have that. So there could be, you know, delay with traffic and that kind of thing. But to your point, yes, absolutely.
And you mentioned earlier about some of the, you know, sort of a breakdown in dispatch communication. There'll be a time lag there. Another thing that jumped out to me also is that you've got, you know, singular functionality, EMS only, versus us looking at putting something in place where they're both firefighters and EMS.
Correct.
Paramedics. And last but not least, they would be housed in our fire stations as non-employees, which that's probably not the best thing to do either.
That's correct. And, you know, as fire chief, I'm responsible and accountable for, you know, our fire operations, and I would not have direct supervision over those, you know, third-party, you know, contracted employees. I would have to go through their supervisor.
That's a really good point, and something I briefly wanted to follow up on. Is that there is really no structured chain of command between these outside contractors and your employees.
That's
the city's employees. But if we did it in-house, we would keep that chain of command structure in place.
Yes, sir.
Chief,
I just wanted to have you remind us of what kind of service we're getting now. I think there are a few weekends in the summertime when we do have an ambulance station here. It's because of an agreement that we have with the county, is it? Can you describe that for us, please?
So we do not have an agreement with the county specifically. What the county does is they have a dynamic staffing model, and so they constantly are shifting and rotating their units where there are holes or where they predict that the next calls might be. And so they will shift those units here to cover, you know, Mount Pleasant or Sullivan's Island, Isle of Palms. It's not specifically for us, but when they do arrive, you know, they're typically, you know, in a parking lot, or they'll come to our fire station and just get in and out real quick because they're on the road. And but we don't have a specific, Charleston County doesn't have a specific agreement with us.
So we never know when they're going to show up?
That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct.
Thank you. That clarifies that.
Yes.
So,
I'd just like to say that I think this is a really exciting opportunity. I think we need to look at those numbers, the cost numbers, one more time to make sure that they are, that we can stomach them and manage that, the levels, because it is expensive. I think the response time will be certainly improve having our paramedics on staff, and the care that we can give to our people will be terrific. So thank you for your work.
Yeah, Chief Roker, a couple of questions and comments. This is what we brought you here for, some of the strategic forward thinking, make sure we're servicing our island appropriately. So thank you for doing that. Any conversation with Sullivan's and joining and doing some kind of cost-sharing arrangement? Would they have any interest in doing that just to cover both islands? Or
it is possible. I'll reach out to Chief Stiff again to see what we might be able to do. If we do that, you know, there would be the challenge of we might need to request more, because if we're sending over there, our residents are expecting a certain level of service that wouldn't be dedicated to Isle of Palms. It's obviously, you know, we could do it, but I don't know. It would be based upon what you would support. But yes, that option is always available.
And lastly, and I know we've got a budget workshop next Tuesday, so I may need to go into the cage for this comment, but our budget cannot absorb $1 million in expenses. I mean, this would absolutely require some type of tax increase or shifting or something. You know, the good news to that is we have a piece of debt rolling off at the end of June, so we'll start our fiscal year with one less piece of obligation debt that would come off that would help offset any type of an increase. I know Debbie's done a little bit of work on, you know, what the revenue would look like, how it would affect our budget. And I think you could look at multiple ways, not just covering it through a tax increase. I mean, you could look at using our general fund to some extent, certainly using some tourism funds to help support, and then maybe a third of that also coming from a tax increase. I mean, I think there's some work to be done from how we fund it, obviously, to you know, take on $1 million in additional expenses for a great service, but you know, just to manage expectations. That's, you know, this is going to be a conversation that we'll need to have next week when we get to the budget side of this.
Thank you.
Chief, thank you. Good work. Next item is item two, discussion of requiring lawn commercial services to remove yard debris from residential rental properties. And I just came up through committee. Rusty, Kevin, Douglas, anybody, there's a sample ordinance in your packet, red line, just to show the change for that. There's any comment from what came out of committee or not?
Is this being recommended by committee?
Yes.
Kevin, you still with us?
Yes, sir, I am.
Did you want to weigh in on this initially?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. Mr. Mayor, Council, this was something I brought up, wanted on the agenda for our committee meeting. Prior to our committee, I was riding down Palm Boulevard from 32nd to 21st, and I think I counted either 9 or 10 or 11 huge piles of debris. And you can tell which is contractor debris and which is homeowners. And I just remember maybe Councilman Ward's public service meetings, maybe last year or the year before, whatever, may have touched on this. But I wanted to just bring it up to see what we could do. I'm not for one for making ordinances that we can't enforce, so that might be the bugaboo about this. But it was just something that just bugged me a little bit, because they're getting away with this, and they're I'm sure they're including in their price to their customers to hauling this stuff off at a premium, but they have, you know, are able to leave it for us to get it. And I think it's just taxing on Donnie, our equipment, the fuel costs, and it's just something that I thought we should really kind of dive in deep. I guess my question would be, and I've read what they've included in red in the ordinance. But I guess I would then follow up with a question of, is this something that would be enforceable? Would we go enforce it to the owner? I'm guessing. versus the contractor or the contractors is light that's with us. So maybe we can hold their feet to the fire with that. But anyway, it was just there was a lot of it laying around, and I thought it was something that we should start discussing and hopefully bubble up to this group.
Chief, you want to comment on enforceability?
Sorry, we'll look at it. This is something I spoke with our code enforcement officer about quite a bit here recently, and I think he and Robert Serra from Public Works and Donnie have all kind of been involved in these conversations. He feels confident that he can enforce this. He had a similar ordinance that he enforced at the previous municipality that he worked for. He's already worked to address this with some of the contractors that were leaving it out. He saw the same issues that Councilman Popson brought up, and he does feel like he could address these. All right, does that answer your question?
And I apologize. I missed our last facilities meeting because I thought that it started at 3 and started at 1. But I had actually wanted this issue to be brought up for kind of similar but different reasons. And that is that, especially back in Forest Trail and on 41st, the road adjacent to 41st, people are in a habit of throwing anything and everything into areas that aren't their property. And so if there's been a question of this, of how that would possibly be enforceable, because, I mean, basically people are dumping on what is not their property, but there's no way of knowing that it's happening because you can't see it happening. But then also just another issue in this is looking at the red line of the ordinance. I mean, here we're talking about adding a section to the ordinance, but if you read the 3 or 4 bullets ahead of it, we're not enforcing any of those because they say that it's all supposed to be bagged. It's supposed to be less than X amount of 3 feet. I can't remember how many feet. And so I just feel like this is a way bigger issue than just whether or not people that are paying someone to clean their yard are taking it away versus a whole island-wide, like what we're doing with our yard waste, how we're removing it, and the enforceability issues that go with that also. So that's a lot. I'm sorry. But.
It is a lot. I will say, I don't know if that's me.
It's everybody.
Are we going to catch them all? No. We can't catch every speeder. We can't catch everybody who violates. But he has already, Code Enforcement Kowski has already stopped several contractors and kind of spoke with them, trying to encourage them to just do the right thing. If you have people that are dumping on somebody else's property, that's a whole separate state statute that we can actually look at and enforce. Again, will we catch them all? No, but we might be able to work on some of those areas where we know we have problems that are occurring quite frequently. The Forest Trail is one of those. We can certainly start working on that, and we can work with some of our friends like Palmetto Pride and stuff like that. They will actually give us some tools because they work on the littering statutes and things. They can help us work on those problem areas so that we can figure out who's doing it and address those issues. We are working more here recently with Donnie and our public works partners to address the entire ordinance as it's written so that we're making sure we're holding everybody accountable to what's in ordinance.
Rusty? Yes, sir. A couple of things to mention here. Coming out of committee, there's no intention for this to affect a full-time resident here. If you do your own yard cleanup, you know, you generate some debris, you cut some palm fronds, clean your yard or whatever, you put it out there, properly bagged, you hope, then that would not affect your resident. The resident, you know, the city would still continue to pick up resident waste under this recommendation here. So no effect on the residents. My largest question would be, is what effect does this have on the availability of service for the island itself, particularly for the small commercial landscaper, business owner who may come over here and they're on kind of a tight budget. If they're having to take all of their debris away, maybe, you know, that could be a hardship on them to the point that we may not have enough people to do all of the yard work that needs to be done around here from a commercial standpoint. You know, someone who gets out and cuts 20 yards and cleans up, you know, cleans up slight amount of debris for, you know, 20 customers or whatever. The larger companies, you know, maybe so, maybe they've already got it, to Kevin's point, burned into their proposal, basically, or their contract, and maybe it's not such a big hardship on them, but I am concerned and I'm a little bit worried about what it would do for the supply of labor for the smaller businessman or businesswoman that's in landscaping.
Yes, sir. We actually implemented an ordinance just like this in my previous municipality that I worked at. And we did not see a significant decrease in businesses that were coming out and working. What we did see was they were more adamant on putting that charge in their estimate when they were coming out to do their work. But we have the same concern that came about when they passed that ordinance, and we did not see a significant decline in businesses.
Thank you, Chief. So, Douglas, I would just say this to council.
Yeah, so I think next steps would be to put it in an ordinance format, have you all have it on your agenda for first reading at the next, at your council meeting.
Next item is discussion of increasing from 2 to 4 the number of resident parking decals that may be issued to a non-resident property owner. This also came through public safety, and it's been on our books since probably 2015, 2016, with our parking plan, but has really been more strongly enforced this year. And a fair amount of feedback from non-resident owners, and I think if we look at increasing this, I think we would take care of most of the situations. 2 cars and a golf cart, 3 cars and a golf cart, whatever, based on conversations I've had. And I know, Chief, you have too. Jimmy, anything to add from public safety?
Just, I'd like to see the workshop recommend this to full council for consideration.
So, Douglas, I think we'll bring that back as an ordinance as well. Yeah. Thank you. Next item is 4, twofold, discussion of hiring a parking vendor for the island and reconfiguring paid parking. We'll take the first one, first item in pieces. So hiring a parking vendor, I know there's been some work done looking at outside companies to do our parking enforcement for us. Douglas, you want to?
Yeah, so I would just say that the city staff has been in contact with parking vendors that have recently responded to surrounding cities' RFPs. That allows us to basically use that process as part of our procurement, to satisfy our procurement code in terms of costing. But we would need to, we're really at a time now with the budget where we would need to analyze, is there an expense here? Is there a revenue here for this upcoming year? And work that into the budget as well as figure out, you know, would the using another community's request for proposals allow us to kind of get it done under that response, or where we need to start the process from scratch. So we have kind of started the analysis of this project, but don't think we're not, you know, at a conclusion by any stretch at this point.
And I guess the offset to this, Chief, would be we wouldn't have as many beach service officers if we outsourced parking, and they would be focused on beach-related activities at that point. Hence their title. Yeah.
And we would get better service as well. I mean, we've talked about this with the Chief, and if we have an outside vendor doing this, they take care of ticketing, they take care of court responsibilities, they take care of the whole gamut, and they can also issue parking decals and some of them do that. Infrastructure is minimal, if anything at all, now from our perspective, because everything's done via satellite and text, so you don't have to have kiosks, you don't have to have any of those types of things. I'm the one that's been pushing this, and I think it's very much needed. If you drive down Palm Boulevard right now, I mean, right this minute, I guarantee you, you'll see violations of our current parking code because we don't have the ability to police it properly. So this is something that I would urge us to look at quickly and push staff to put something in place as quickly as we can.
Can I just have a question? What is the reconfiguring of paid parking? What does that mean?
That's a separate issue, Scott, but the suggestion is that we start charging for parking on Palm Boulevard and make the city lot in the commercial district free, which then pushes more people to the commercial district A, and then B would take some of the load off of Palm Boulevard because we can price it in such a way that it would allow more people to go to the beach, and it creates turnover instead of people parking there for 10, 12 hours at a time.
Mr. Mayor, I'd just like to say that two things. One, that I think we need to study this carefully. When you remove any fees for parking, then what happens is it's usually abused where you have vehicles come and park for the full day, so you have less turnover, and you have more problems that are caused because now the people coming to the beach can't find spaces because they're being overused. The second thing is I would like to study this much further and postpone any decisions on changing how we pay, charge for parking here on the island until the lawsuit that's in front of the state is resolved so that we will know what we can do after that.
Yeah. Let's separate these issues for just a second. I'd love to hear from Chief on the outsourcing the parking enforcement, for lack of a better term.
Yes, sir. We're a fan.
Thank you, Chief.
Yeah. We're a fan. What we see with it is, and as Mr. Hahn pointed out, Councilman Hahn brought it up last year, if we have a call that comes out on the beach for a missing person or something like that, I pull all my resources because that's the most important priority for me at that point, to include our beach service officers. They're not writing parking tickets. We're out there for however long it takes to find that individual. And during that time, there are several cars at park, and we are not able to. Then we're playing catch-up when we're done with this, trying to catch all these violators. And I do strongly believe, in talking to the other counterparts and municipalities that have done this, you do see better enforcement when you outsource it because that's what they're paid to do specifically. They don't have any other job. They do parking. And we've talked with several municipalities that have gone this route, and I've worked for some that have their own departments that do it, and then talked with several that just outsource it. And it's you have a better resource for it. We do have a position where we've got to look at how much money it's going to cost to facilitate it, and is it the best thing for the city overall? And we've kind of talked with Desiree and Douglas and Debbie. I haven't talked to all three of them at once about it, but in separate conversations, we've all talked. And they're all the same concerns of where does it fall budgetarily. It will relieve some of that financial use of BSOs. We won't need 10 at that point. We could probably reduce that down maybe 5 or so like that are actually on the beach, and that's now they're enforcing your alcohol on the beach, your glass on the beach, and those types of things.
Is it like almost like a performance base, or is it a straight fee? In other words, do they get paid on the number of tickets they write, or do they get just a straight fee?
The one that I saw looked like it was a straight fee for everything, and then they all build in different things that they'll bring to the table. Some would offer, they buy their own license plate reader that works with our kiosks. They take over our kiosk maintenance, and so then we don't have anything to do with that. They take over the permitting, so even your residential decals, it's all run through the same system that they're familiar with working with, which is the same system we currently use. And they would do all of that for you, to include reducing the work on our clerk of court and Laura and the individuals that are up front dealing with the constant calls about parking tickets or the people coming up there, because this company would address all of that. They would deal with all the court issues and all the tickets in general.
Yeah, would it be possible to get a... maybe a place to start for me, because it sounds like we've got kiosk provision, we've got monitoring maintenance, we've got court, we've got all the administrative back office that goes with it. Do we have a list of what is included in this potential scope of service for this outside vendor? Because as I recall, in many municipalities, it's sort of like a buffet. You can have them do everything, or you can have them do certain parts of it. And I'm not clear with this one line item here what it is we're actually talking about. Sounds like we've got some good potential, and it might be the way to go. I just have no idea what scope we're talking about here. And I think that would be a very helpful place to start if we could define what it is that we're looking at.
I think that's where we're at now, too, is trying to build that. You know, what are they offering? What do we currently have? And how would that all be impacted? So that's part of the discussion. I think that's why Mr. Carr was saying that we're not at a point where we're ready to...
As much as I want to say,
let's do this today, I don't think we're in the position to make the best decision with all the information that's been looked at so far.
Yeah, the season is obviously pretty much here at this point. We have, we're underway of trying to hire the BSOs to handle it this season. We're kind of at the very beginning of figuring out the scope, how that scope would relate to other responses for proposals to see if we can piggyback on. So I think the staff has seen it as this is our time to kind of build out the program to see what the budgetary impact is for your upcoming budget. So that's our kind of next step is to put those pieces together to see it. Does it make a little money? Does it cost money? What's the financial impact? And have it ready to go for next season.
Jimmy?
Yeah, I'd just like to see it referred by the folks. Safety board, a lot more work, a lot more questions. Have you, to Scott's point, as far as Buffet goes, have you thought about whether they would need a physical structure, an office or not?
That is something that the one proposal that we've received so far did say that they would like an office space. And that would be something we would have to look at is where that office space is. And then to make it even more complicated, I think to make it function at its best possible ability, it needs to be an office space with a window where people can come to it. Otherwise, they're going to have to be getting up and going to that window. So it's something that we would have to take into account when we're looking at that is where is that going to be?
Yes, sir. All right. Thank you.
Yes, sir.
But, yeah, like refer back to both safety and, as Doug said, it needs a lot more work. I don't have this year.
Yeah. So I think this whole line item does. Because, you know, pushing everybody to, whatever your comment, pushing everybody to the municipal lot, I mean, then we don't create turnover there, right, for...
We're going to charge for all of it.
Yeah.
Okay. We got no turnover on Palm Boulevard now. We have people storing vehicles on Palm Boulevard.
Right. And that's what I'm saying. So if we push the...
Agreed. We're doing what we need to do. We're getting on the agenda.
I think also that we have a plan that we're working with the South Carolina Department of Transportation on conceptually redoing Palm Boulevard.
Right.
So I don't think we should be messing around with anything with parking to understand what the potential is for that reconfiguring that Palm Boulevard.
Yeah, and I think the first draft is back of that potential, John, of options. I hope we're going to have DOT and their consultant and our traffic engineer consultant at our end of March meeting. It's not confirmed yet, but to look at two things. The options that they come up with for Palm Boulevard and the resident citizen feedback on the connector survey that's out there. So I hope that's happening at the end of this month. So. Right. Item D, discussion of approval of short-term rental coordinator position. In your package, you've got a job description. This is one we've talked about off and on for the last couple months or so, and this would be housed in the building group, obviously,
does
with anything.
Yes, I would just say that this has come through committee, and I'm fairly confident there's been a recommendation that the council consider adding this position. Would be a new position in the building department. There, we believe, and I guess we would like to get council's buy-in to the idea of hiring this position in this fiscal year. We think that we have adequate room within the budget because of other staffing that didn't happen that leaves room in the budget to cover this. So we're going to be asking that you approve the job description and at the same time bless the staff to start the process of hiring this individual. A little detail, the physical demands that in the job description generated some questions, which led to the staff sending this job description to our human resources attorney, and he is reworking that description. It will not change really the meaning of that those demands, but it will be reworded, and he felt like it can be improved upon. So it'll be slightly tweaked at your council meeting, but that's what the expectation is, or the hope is that at your next meeting we can get your blessing on both the position and actually hiring the individual. Starting to hire the individual.
Yeah. Because Douglas, if we approve at the end of March, like by the time we start interviewing, get somebody on staff, whether they're internal or external, our fiscal year is at June, and we're not talking about a big budget number,
right?
And we've got savings to your point.
Correct.
Yeah. Where would you put them?
It's an excellent question.
Wait till you get through this budget workshop next week. A conversation about the City Hall now.
City Hall.
Other questions, comments? All right, item E, other items for discussion. One, discussion of proposal from Coast Architects in an amount ranging between $60,000 and $90,000 for the design and development of construction documents to install elevator at the Marina restaurant. We have this proposal in your packet. I know this has come through the committee. Douglas or Rusty, anybody want to opine?
You'll kick it off, Douglas?
Yes, yes. This is what's in your packet is their proposal to handle this work in two phases. The first part of the work would be, and it's what they're asking to be approved at this point, would be really a due diligence assessment to figure out which elevator, and it would be a similar work product to what Trident did, but it would be by a professional designer, where Trident did not have a professional designer involved. So we think it would be at the end of that process, they would tell us really the cost, the location, and the best product for that application. The Trident proposal had what's called a Lula, which is kind of a lighter duty elevator. They instantly kind of questioned whether or not that was the best way to go. So if that were to go, if we were to progress from that phase into design phase, there would be an additional agreement with Coast, and that's why there's a range given there on your agenda. That one, the high end of the range is obviously a more expensive elevator, and the lower end of the range would be probably that lighter duty Lula elevator.
And Douglas, based on this design cost, what do we interpolate that to mean for a total cost?
That's it. So we generally hear that 10% of a design fee is what you can kind of guess. They're guessing the construction cost to be. That puts this fee pretty far out of line with what Trident came back with. And I think theirs was 350, is that right, Rusty?
350 to 4.
350 to 4. If you do the math here, it's beyond that considerably.
So 600,000 and 900,000?
It's what the range would indicate. But yeah, it could be a different, you know, maybe we can't apply that multiplier here.
It just seems really excessive for us to even go down this path. What, you know, to spend $60,000 to $90,000 for an architectural view of something that seems out of reason in terms of cost. I don't know why we'd want to pursue this at this point.
Totally agree.
Yeah, that lease is signed. Is this addressed in that lease? That's a triple net lease with the restaurant.
Yes, sir.
Operated, right?
Yes, and I guess. And I think you'll know the story, but the initial design that council approved showed an elevator. They got into the construction of the elevator, of the project, and determined an elevator wasn't feasible where they had planned it. They came back to council, got permission to proceed without an elevator, and it was at that time that there was, I would say not a commitment, but there was an acknowledgement that a elevator would be looked at some point in the future. So this is kind of finishing that process and considering an elevator at this time.
Mayor, if I may, to follow up on that, when you said that it was a commitment to at least look at an elevator of the future, as I understand it, they were supposed to pay for the elevator to begin with, and we told them that they didn't have to pay for that elevator, so why has the cost now been shifted to us to look at an elevator in the future?
So the recommendation at the time was to consider using tourism funds to do it. And that, there again, I guess I used the word commitment, and I probably shouldn't have. It was not, there was not a commitment. It was a discussion that you're having now, but that was the idea, was, you know, that to serve. Still your money.
Rusty, go ahead.
Okay, all right. Let me give a little history lesson on this whole thing here. Initially, as Douglas said, there was the belief that we were going to have an elevator in that building, which the cost would have been borne by the tenants themselves as they were redoing it. That got taken out of the initial design. We ended up as a council forgiving that and saying, okay, you know, no elevator for now, because structurally where it was located, it turned out it was not feasible in that location. We did go back and we looked at other ways. I know Douglas was out there a lot, and I think had some people with him, and they, along with the tenants, looked at other areas, including the outside and behind the restaurant or on the side of the restaurant, to see if there was a way that we could put some type of elevator in, as we had initially had thought there would be. Couldn't find any real way to do that. So we went ahead, allowed them to go ahead with the project without an elevator. We, at some point, I guess it was fall of 21, we had this item still on the agenda, and we discussed it in council, and the way we left it at that point is that we would still pursue the option of having an elevator in that building that we own, but we would also look and see if there were ways that we could put an elevator in there in the future and pay for it through ATAX funds, accommodations tax. So that's the way we left it, and we brought it up again this past year because it was some unfinished business. Now, personally, I think we at least ought to go through the proposal here to look at the feasibility, which is $19,270. Go ahead and finish doing that, looking at the feasibility and see what Coast Architects come up with. And, you know, we don't know if it's going to be a $600,000 or $700,000 or $800,000 elevator. I wouldn't want to sign off on that, but we do need, I think, to at least let these people who are the architects for this sort of thing take a good look at it, come back to us with some proposals, and just see if it's feasible or not. One other thing I'll say is that recently we had a beach advocates meeting here on this island, had a lot of people attended. It was held at Wild Dunes, but one of the things that we did near the conclusion of that meeting was we had a field trip to Dewey's Island, and we had a reception and dinner afterwards at Islander 71. And Islander 71 did a great job, you know, helping us out there, and just great host and hostesses there. No problem with that at all. But what we saw also just in that one excursion there, that one meeting, that one dinner and reception, there were two people that were part of that beach advocates group that could not access the upper level where we were having cocktails for the dinner. One of them was in a wheelchair and I think probably a lifelong occupant of a wheelchair. But she could not get up there at all, obviously. And then there was a gentleman who was a little bit infirm. He didn't have a cane or anything, but he chose to go only halfway up the steps and not go up either. He just didn't feel comfortable going on up to the second level. And I say that because that's initially where we had the reception. Everybody was gathering up there, having their drinks, and it was going to be set up for dinner, a buffet downstairs later. So some of us, you know, but knowing that the lady could not get up there, the gentleman couldn't get up there to the second level, made sure that we went back down and spent some time with them at that first level, and they were served drinks down there as well, you know. So I just saw it firsthand. It's like, okay, as an island that we say, that we have said in resolutions, that we're not only going to be ADA compliant, but we're going to go over and above what we need to do to be ADA compliant. Is this really what we want to stand for? And that's one event that I saw that, which tells me it happens a lot, probably. You know, it probably happens every week at some point. And I'm not saying this to shame any of us or anything, but it is our building. It's our property. And I just think we ought to do the due diligence here and see if there is a possibility of moving forward this project, and also to see if there's a possibility to offset the cost of this, if it is feasible, through some accommodations tax dollars. So that's where I stand on it, and I would just like to see us move forward at least with the initial piece of this.
Douglas, to Rusty's comment, the original $19,000, $17,000, whatever it is, I mean, that's no design. That's not anything other than a due diligence.
That's correct.
Right? I mean, yeah. I don't know what we're going to get for that. And I guess the other thing, too, I mean, you would not have issued a CO, obviously, if this thing is not ADA compliant.
That's correct.
Kevin. Kevin's got a... Let me get Kevin in here while he's back.
Mayor, just while yeah. it's...
Go ahead.
The building does not have to... It doesn't have to comply with the ADA standards. So I guess when I answered that it is ADA compliant, that top floor does not have to comply. So, correct. Okay. So,
Let me get Kevin in here. Kevin, go ahead.
Thanks, Mr. Mayor. I'm in total agreement with Councilman Streetman. We committed to looking at this. I don't see where it hurts us to at least do this due diligence to see if it's all possible. Personally, I think their number for construction drawings is way over the top expensive. And it probably doesn't even include a structural engineer's reviewing it and stamping it as well, which is probably more money. However, I may be wrong with that. But I agree that we should at least look at it. We said we would, and I could support at least the due diligence part of it.
Jan.
Thank you.
Yep, thank you.
Okay. First of all, I agree with Councilman Streetman that the building should be ADA accessible to everyone. And my understanding of the ADA compliancy, though, is the reason why we could... is this a new structure or a renovated structure?
It's a renovated structure.
So therefore, it doesn't have to fulfill the requirements?
That's correct.
Okay. So that explains that. But my understanding with design fees and whatnot, and that was my job... is that the smaller the project, the higher percentage goes into design fees. However, with design fees of $60,000 to $90,000, I don't see this being any less than the estimate that we've already gotten from the other firm. So if we're going into this, I just want the council to be aware we're talking a minimum of probably $250,000 to $350,000 to install an elevator. And it looks like from where this is starting, it's going to be more than that.
Yeah, I think we've already had feasibility studies done two or three times now. And they say it's not feasible, except for spending $350,000. So we're now going to spend another $20,000 for someone saying, well, it's not feasible, except you want to spend $350,000, $400,000. So I think we know what the end result is. I don't know why we keep going to ask people for a different answer. I mean, I think we have to make a decision whether we want to spend $350,000, $400,000 on the elevator, or we don't. Not spend another architectural review of it.
I don't think we know what the cost is going to be. No, we haven't had other feasibility studies. We've had opinions. We had at least one opinion from Trident, who is not the expert. We have not had a feasibility study on this.
Yeah, just
the letter specifically says that the design fees will be between $40,000 and $70,000, right?
Right.
So, okay. Yeah. I mean, they're not going to give us a $10,000 elevator with $70,000 design fees. I mean, like, let's be realistic here. It's going to cost at the very minimum and probably going to be significantly more than $200,000. So if we're not willing to spend $200,000 on an elevator, then why are we going to throw $19,000 in the trash can?
We also said that we would make every effort to pay all or part of this through accommodations tax dollars. So let's take that in consideration, too. I'm not saying we need to make an agreement whether we're going to spend $350,000, $400,000. If we do the due diligence and it comes back and we see it's going to be a very, very large price tag, which in all likelihood it's going to be, then we also, concurrent with this, we need to be looking at what the feasibility is of offsetting this cost with the accommodations tax dollars, as was originally recommended, motion made, seconded, and voted on in the prior council, of which I was part of.
Are we looking for a recommendation tonight or not?
Conversation, and just we'll bring it to the council and vote at the end of March.
Okay. Back up to John's comment about feasibility studies being done, and I thought you said concluded that it was not feasible. Is it? And just to clarify, is that what you said?
I probably did say that, but the options that, as I remember from the initial thing, were some very almost residential grade elevators to put in there. And the whoever the last people who put a more commercial elevator in was a very expensive proposition. You know, it was $350,000. And so either you put in a commercial or residential that they're saying it's not, it really, you can't do in that application, or you spend $400,000.
But I'm following now. So at the end of that process, Trident concluded that it was feasible, which kind of led us to the this being the next step. Just want to be sure I understood that.
I'd also like to point out that the bathrooms on the top floor are not ADA compliant, nor can they be made ADA compliant. So we would be encouraging people to go upstairs to a place where they didn't have ADA compliant bathrooms.
They could take an elevator back down to the bathroom.
Typically not required. What ADA requires in other buildings. So okay. If we're looking for ADA compliance,
it was not required. I got it all. I know that. I know exactly what you're talking about there. We went through this discussion over a year ago.
So at the end of March meeting, are we really talking about, do we want to go forward and explore spending $300,000 to $400,000 or more $1,000 on an elevator? And spend $20,000 to get to that point, or just make the decision.
Yeah.
So we're going to do all this over again at the end of March, right?
Pretty much.
Just vote at the end of March.
Well, no discussion? No. We're going up and down.
All right, item two, discussion regarding an appreciation plaque at the Recreation Center honoring Norma Jean, our former longtime recreation director. I think this came through committee, something I would certainly support. But go ahead.
Yeah, I'll talk to this, Mr. Mayor. I was approached several weeks ago now by a group of citizens, and one in particular, and I'll just leave the names out on it, you know, just because I'm not sure she would want me to do it publicly. I don't think she'd have a problem with it, but she approached me with the idea and through discussion with other residents with the possibility of honoring Norma Jean because of all her years of service and heading up the rec department with some sort of appreciation plaque or something to just commemorate all of her service and everything she's done for the island over the years. And I thought it was a good idea myself. And she spoke at our committee this past week about that as well. And she also had a document which she delivered to us. It had, I think, 260 signatures attached to it of residents that had circulated that were asking, you know, or at least supporting the same thing. So I thought that was pretty significant as well. I think we made that part of the record, Nicole, with the signatures.
Yes,
it's all part of our committee record. So I'm certainly in favor of us entertaining as a council doing something with an appreciation plaque or appreciation marker of some kind. It's very prominent for Norma Jean.
Okay.
documents.
Sounds good.
Okay, I don't, I mean, we're allowing y'all, we need to vote on this or whatever at the end of March, but I think
yeah, they go vote at the end of March.
Okay. Item three, discussion of having residents speak first during citizens' comments. I'm assuming, I think this came through administrative committee, John.
Yeah, I don't know, Scott, you want to talk about this?
Sure, I think we passed this subject around. I think that a lot of the residents, and myself included, I want to be very clear that the residents have an opportunity to go first. I think we've got a lot of good discourse that goes on amongst the residents, and I think sometimes there's a little bit of confusion when the residents have stopped spoken and when we've got a non-resident speaking. I'd like to kind of have a clear demarcation of the residents speaking first in the order. I think right now it's the first sign up, first speak. Is that correct, Nicole?
Yes, sir.
Yep.
Let the residents all speak first before we go to the non-resident speakers. That way also, I don't, you know, I'm not suggesting that we shorten any time. I'm not suggesting that we don't hear from everybody. But I think that demarcation would be helpful, I think, in the presentation of the remarks. And also, in the event that we ever do have a time crunch, that the residents are prioritized in the speaking order. So I'd just like to suggest that that be made official.
How would you go about doing that? Is that something we can do?
I don't know about can do, but it would require a change to the city code since it says first come, first serve.
But as a practical matter?
Well, people are required. It says, you know, at the top of the agendas and on the website that they're required to give their name and their address and the topic that they're going to discuss. And I would say that, you know, maybe 75% of them do all of those things.
About close to 100% do it.
Well, no, they do it when they get up there. But I'm saying when they email me, they'll just go, particularly people that we hear from quite a bit, will just say, Nicole, I want to talk, and I kind of already know what they're going to talk about. But generally, the address is usually not even on it, and because that's not, something I'm supposed to be considering, I don't make a point of it of asking for it. I just put their name on the list.
Rusty,
thank you. I voted nay on this coming out of committee, and the reason I did is not because I don't believe that residents shouldn't speak, but I believe everybody should speak, and I firmly believe that this is a public forum. It should be open to anyone that wants to speak to us. It always has been since I've been on here. And I think if you go back and look at the records, and I'm sure we've got our historian here, Councilmember Ward, who could tell us that people have been welcome to speak at these meetings, whether they're residents or not. We certainly want to hear everybody's voice heard. I mean, wherever council decides to land on something like this, if it's all speak, all residents first, and then anyone that's a non-resident last, I mean, we can go that way, but I will remind people, too, that we sometimes have exigent circumstances that arrive in this meeting, too. I remember a couple of years ago, we had a lady from Mount Pleasant that came over with her husband begging for a beach wheelchair. Remember that conversation?
Yes, sir.
And we let her go pretty early in the process there. We let her speak. She wasn't a formal presenter, but she got up and she pleaded about how she had been directed down to 42nd Avenue and went down there. There was no pizza stand, no bathroom, no hot dogs, and she couldn't get on the beach. And she had a very heartfelt plea. And in that situation there, her and her husband were pressed for time. She was allowed to go first because of her situation. We've had a number of times at Beach Santa. We all know Spirit of the Island Award. He comes and speaks. He lives in up near Monk's Corner, between Goose Creek and Monk's Corner. So I'm not saying that we should have any squelching of people weighing in or whatever, whether it be residents or non-residents, but we also ought to leave it open and optional that if we have exigent circumstances, that we allow someone that's not a resident to go ahead and speak. And I don't think we ever should get in a time crunch on this council that we would cut anybody off. I mean, if we have to stay here late to get it done, we should stay here late and get it done. Now, I do think we should hold people to 3 minutes as much as possible, and I do think we ought to encourage people who are going to be speaking on the same subject to at least have a spokesperson to go ahead and say, I'm speaking for all of these people. That would be great, too, if we had that on any subject. Now, how hard that is to manage and police is probably pretty tough to do. So, but my only point I'm trying to make on this is nobody should be turned away if they want to speak, whether it be resident or non-resident, and we should have an ability to have exigent circumstances for someone who needs to speak to this council about something, whether they're a resident or not, and possibly letting them go before all the residents have a chance to speak. Just leave it open that way.
Right.
Sure. At the risk of being contrary to what everybody else has said, at some time, it is an advantage to speak last and not first. And so perhaps we should allow residents to decide do they want to be at the beginning of the pack or the end of the pack. If I'm speaking to council, I want to be the last guy up because I want to know everybody else has already said. So, I mean, we're chasing shadows basically on how you do this because nobody knows what is going to be the best at the end of the day.
So you spoke last.
There you go.
I think it works fine the way it is, but yeah. I don't know what's needed. Doug, what's from the next step?
Mr. Mayor?
Yes, sorry, Jim.
I just wanted to say that I think what we're talking about is still having everyone allowed to speak, so I don't think that's even being considered the opposite. I do think, especially when we have a large number of speakers, that having residents speak first, giving them the option, and making it something like if they sign up and do not give an address, then they would be considered not a resident, is one way to deal with it in terms of who wants to sign up and speak first and who doesn't. The residents have an option of speaking first. I think that just gives us the opportunity that if we are running extremely long in a meeting, I think we have a 30-minute time slot now for comments. We do suspend the rules of order. We can always suspend the rules of order when we need to, but that's always an option too.
Kevin, oops, sorry, Jim.
Thanks, Mr. Mayor. Sorry, I might be missing something, but how are we going to know if they're a resident or not? I mean, I could have a rental home. I can get up there and say, I'm Kevin Popson at 830 Second Avenue, and you don't know if I'm a resident or not. So, I mean, I'm okay just as long as everybody gets to talk, but I just don't know how we figure out who's a resident and who are not and how we line them up. Thank you.
Homeowner. Just call them a homeowner.
I'd rather not have to police people's IDs.
Want to vote on that, Marsh?
Yeah.
I'm not hearing a lot of support. So.
No? No.
Yeah. But yeah.
Well, I'd like to bring it up.
It's an ordinance change that we need to. Go ahead, Nicole.
Tony, would you like me to ask some other municipalities how they handle that?
Sure.
Yeah, I think we know of at least one other that does do it that way. Would you all mind if we say, hearing that it's not unanimous one way or the other, that we don't put it into an ordinance just yet? Is that right? As a concept, we'll give an actual vote on the concept.
It works. Thank you, Douglas, for clarifying. Item 4, discussion of adopting resolution to support adoption of House Bill Pinckney Hate Crime Act. You have the act in your packet.
I recommend we move forward to the council for all.
Yeah, it's real quick. We're one of two states in the whole country that doesn't have this, and it's passed the House, headed to the Senate. They may take action before we get to council meeting, but you have a sample in your packet. Any other comments or thoughts?
I second it.
All right.
I heartily support this.
Debbie, we're going to have to put you at first at some meeting in the future here. Sorry. Financial results are in your packet.
All right, folks. We've got February results to review.
Okay, make sure you're right.
I hear myself. Okay. So I think I'm So, our target for expenditures is 67%, or 67% through the fiscal year. General fund revenues are at 66%. Total revenues are at 66%, and general fund expenses are at 66%. So we are, like, right on target.
That's good budgeting there.
Mm-hmm. I think February is the sweet spot, because it's never lines up like that. But one reason it is, property taxes, we're pretty much done collecting those, but we haven't started collecting business license revenues and rental license revenues. Those are due April 30th, so the second few months of the year we'll see that revenue flow. Cash balances, the city has approximately $37 million in cash deposits. 95% of those are invested at the local government investment pool with an interest rate of 4.75%.
That's big money.
That's good money.
Yep. Well, it has been.
Of the $37 million, $1.9 million represents unspent bond proceeds, $2.2 million unspent federal ARP funding, and $16.5 million is restricted for tourism and beach preservation.
Is that ARP money allocated yet?
We haven't.
Yeah, but I mean, have we assigned it to projects yet?
Well, we'll talk about that during budget time.
Okay.
Just foreshadowing, where the current draft of the budget uses a half of it for the public dock, but the other half is, as of yet, undecided. Okay, I can go through the tourism revenue schedules, but they look good.
Yeah, they look great.
Not much different from last month. Drainage Phase 3 project worksheet. We have had some pay apps related to the Forest Trail and 30th Avenue outfall project. But still, over $1 million unspent on the construction budget. Next project worksheet is marine improvements. This includes now, for the first time, the contract for the Blue Tide marine construction modifications to the timber bulkhead. The work has been going on. It was just not included, my bad, on the project worksheet. And then the first pay app on that contract for $9,000, paid in January.
And it looks great.
It does. That's all I have.
Thank you, Debbie. Item 8, procurement, discussion of approval of notice of intent to purchase Caterpillar front loader for public works in fiscal 24. The only reason we're bringing this up now, 8 months lead time at best, probably, to get one of these in. So we'd like to start the process now, if that was
done. That's correct. I think that's it. This is on the state procurement pricing list, so we will proceed accordingly there.
Very good.
All right. Last item, Douglas, you want to do our capital projects update for us?
Yes. I'll quickly run through these. Been a lot of work going on in the last month. As you will, I'm sure, have noticed, the drainage work at 30th Avenue is almost completed. There's great inlets there that are not in place. There's some kind of final cleanup that needs to be done, but the road's open. And it's right at kind of 95% done. That the next part of that process will be at 36th Avenue. We were hoping and anticipating kind of immediately starting that project and installing another detour at 36th Avenue. However, we have run into a similar issue that we had at 30th with a supply chain issue with the concrete box culvert that has to go across that stream. And there's a little bit of a, there's an issue between the contractor, the designer, and at the end of the day, the pipe provider. So we are very close now to a time frame that if we don't, we're going to have a meeting on Thursday, and we think that if we don't have kind of a final determination on Thursday, that this would put the closure, the end of the closure, well into June or getting into June, which we wanted to avoid at all costs. So if that's the case, we are anticipating that we would discuss delaying that till the end of August. We just didn't think it would be prudent to have that road closure in June and then, you know, into the summer. So we're having those discussions right now, and we hope that we can get a little bit more clarity on Thursday. We're still waiting for the Corps of Engineers. When we talk about 41st for a second, those permits have been issued with the exception of the Corps of Engineers permit. We were under the impression that that was going to be kind of a rubber stamp at the end of the process, but I think through some turnover at their office, it's turned into a little more time than they would have anticipated. We're expecting that, I think, and I think the mayor called their office and they indicated a few weeks, I think, was the last.
I think the first thing to do is this. I think they're finalizing the paperwork to get us approval, and you know, they know all we're trying to do is get everything lined up, ready to go in the fall
right. For
construction. So we're our windows closing here, so right. Hopefully it'll happen.
The drainage, the comprehensive drainage master plan. This one, as you all will recall, Davis and Floyd has had some staff turnover there. And they have a new team getting up to speed, but we've met with them several times. We're excited about the new team just as we were about the old team. They seem to be picking the ball right up where it was left. They have completed a draft of the plan with projects and costs in it. They are refining that plan, and that will wrap up a major portion of their work, leaving their final steps of reviewing our development standards. Part of what they're going to do is look at our codes, how we allow things to be built, advise us on things like lot coverage and impervious surfacing requirements. So they still have that piece of work outstanding. They're also going to create what we think of as kind of an asset management plan for all of our drainage systems. As you all know, we have an agreement with EDs. And Robert and Public Works staff are doing, they're going in a somewhat reactive process now, and we would like that to pivot to be more proactive and planned and scheduled. So they're working on that. They will come to this group and present all of this. We are expecting it within the next few months to get that to you. They're doing good work at Davis and Floyd.
Can I ask a question?
Sure, yeah.
On the top of the slide, the third bullet, the city has requested a proposal to determine the cost of having DNF analyze the phase three area?
Yes. May I explain that?
Yes.
So the phase three area is really the forest trail area between kind of 30th and 41st. That area was analyzed by Thomas and Hutton when they were designing the outfalls to be sure that the outfalls would be sized appropriately. But they did not do the level of modeling and analysis that Davis and Floyd is doing. So what we're a little bit worried about is we're going to get one part of the island that's been completely modeled and planned and another part that's just planned at a different level. So to have everything kind of an apples-to-apples comparison for going forward, for things like the maintenance of that system going forward, we think it would be useful to have all of it analyzed to the same level. So we're still waiting for a proposal from them to do that
additional work.
So it's just a consistent model. Thank
yes. Okay. Go to underground utility, 21st and Palm. Probably most of you saw that they were out there today doing that work. We expect it shouldn't take more than a few days for them to complete their work. Still a little bit unsure if there's going to continue to be. It's not unusual for Comcast to leave a line after the power lines are done, so having a cable line at the tail end of that project, and Comcast would have to come out after the fact. So they're only moving the power lines, not the cable TV lines, but that will also be part of the project. So there could be a slight delay after this week's work to get the final lines and final poles down. But we're happy to see them here working and moving lines. The pickleball court, that too, they have come back to work either today or yesterday. They're doing the fencing now. They were in place doing that fencing, so happy to see them back. And Carrie and her team are going to be looking to scheduling, you know, when they have some events coming up and trying to figure out if those events will be able to take advantage of that new area or not. So that work is progressing well.
And you are removing the striping from the tennis courts after the pickleball courts are finished?
I think one of the two, is that correct, Carrie? One of the two will be exclusive tennis. One will be flexible, could be used either way.
We received a number of emails from people requesting the removal of bus drivers, so thank you.
Final project is the...
There's actually two built up. She made it two, just so you know.
Okay. Yeah, I think that's it.
TDOC, I'll just touch on the public dock rehabilitation and the TDOC. We have a meeting. We're setting a meeting. I'm not sure that this week will work, but we're trying to set up a meeting with the tenants over the TDOC. You'll recall that there was money in this year's budget. We deferred doing a project to allow the new operator to get into place. They thought that money could be better utilized than the way we had planned, so we're going to circle back with them and finalize what the thoughts are for next year's budget. So we're working on that. We have also been just kind of, while I'm talking about the marina site, we have been in contact with the marina operator on their work at the store, which is progressing well, and they finally got their permits for the parking lot, and we expect them to start reconfiguring their side of the parking lot in the next, maybe not this week, maybe next week. All with a goal of opening at the end of April is their target. Also working through a new playground structure on the adjacent to the bulkhead. Think that's really going to turn out well. The public dock rehabilitation, as you all know, is in for permitting. Kind of working through that with OCRM, with ATM. The lead of that. And then final project is the marina bulkhead, which your slide says it's done. It's not completely done. It still has an electrical component. There are downlights on those posts that will be added. So they're very close to done. Go look if you haven't. Really turned out well. I'm very proud of that. So any questions on any of those?
Thank you, Douglas. Nothing from the legislative report. Miscellaneous, we've got our budget workshop next Tuesday at 3. I think we're going to do that here at City Hall. Just due to what's going on at the rec center, which is good stuff. So we'll just do it here at 3 o'clock next Thursday. You know what other business?
Motion to adjourn.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
On the record at 7:39. Thank you.
See you, Kevin.
Later.